Mrs. Pravda, reel one. Where were you born, Mrs. Pravda?
I was born in Prague in 1918, after the First World War. And I was an only child.
Can you give me your exact date of birth?
29th of January, 1918.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father was a lawyer. My father was a lawyer who became a lawyer of a bank founded by the Czech legions, by the army, called Legio Banka. He was a fervent patriot. He didn't feel particularly Jewish. I didn't have any religious education. Both my parents were Czech, generation and generation back. And my grandfather, who was very interested in history, used to take me through the old town of Prague, saying, if ever anybody would tell you that Czech Jews don't belong here, look at the graves and the synagogues. They were all founded in the 8th and 9th and 10th century, and the one which is standing even today, the sort of new old synagogue in Prague, was built on a foundation of an older one in the year 1230. So we didn't have a feeling we were foreigners in that land. We belonged to that land, we loved that land, and I say we were very, very patriotic. So it wouldn't occur to us to feel that one should go somewhere else. We were at home.
Where were you educated?
I was educated in Prague. I had a normal education. We were 45 children in the school, in gymnasium, what it's called, high school. And there were four so-called Jewish children. And the only difference between these and the others was that we were not supposed to sit through the lessons of Catholic religion. But as it was not compulsory, of course we did, because it was raining outside or snowing outside. So I had a very nice Catholic education, because the priest was especially nice to me. And, there was no anti-Semitism. Perhaps behind our back somebody said something, not about the children, but about some neighbor. But I never heard anything. Never heard anything, and this is why the illusion that we were not different from anybody else was deep, deep, not only in me as a child, but in my parents, my relatives. And there was no tension. Quite different to the people who lived in Poland, I believe, and in other countries.
How old were you when you finished your education?
I finished my education at the age of 18. But I ran away to play theater and be in films before I finished my education. I'm an actress. I'm still trying to be an actress. So I made my first film at the age of 15 and 16 in the vacation time. And then I played in a lovely Moravian town called Olomouc before the war. And enjoyed life very much indeed. Then I was taken to a called Městské divadlo in Prague, which is the town theater, a very beautiful old theater. And then I was mildly told in 1938 that perhaps the season will be my last season because I was Jewish, because the Sudetenland was taken and the tensions started to build up and people were afraid to employ Jews. So 1939, my career finished.
Can you remember Munich?
Of course I can remember you, Munich. And I tell you something about the Czech nation, about the characteristic of it. As students, we went to protest in front of a building of the university. And there was a great conglomeration, you know, protesting about the debacle and about the horrible letdown of France and England, whom we trusted. And next to me stood a man who said to me, please be aware, don't break the rose bushes. So our manifestations were not violent, you see. That was typical of the Czechs. Don't break the roses. Which remained with me like a leading line We are not a violent nation.
Was there much anti-British and anti-French feeling at the time of Munich?
And I wouldn't say anti-British. The British were not as familiar to us, in spite that our President Masaryk was married to an American woman and he was very, very pro-British, and so was his son, Honza Masaryk. But the general education in Czech schools was more linked to the French culture. We were sort of besotted after the First World War, I believe, you know, with La Douce France. So the letdown and later the debacle, the three-week war in France and the collapse of French, was felt deeper. We didn't so know, at least I speak for myself, I did not know enough about England.
Was it a feeling of bitterness towards France?
Enormous, enormous. And the offer that, I don't know if it was a genuine offer, what we heard about, that the Russians wanted to go alone, did a lot psychologically, you know, to feel that perhaps they were our only friends.
Was this demonstration in Prague?
It was in Prague, it was probably in other cities, but I remember the one. You see, the Czech army was unproportionately big. We had 2 million people. For a nation of 14 million, it was a big army. And my boyfriend, whom I was very much in love with, was mobilized. And we were enthusiastic. We wanted to fight. We wanted to stop. We wanted to do exactly what the Poles did later on. There wasn't any feeling of passivity. You know, everybody rushed to the barracks before he was called. It was almost the spirit of Israel today. If you're threatened, go for it. And when we heard that the weapons were taken from the soldiers and the soldiers were shut in the barracks, the feeling of betrayal was horrible, tremendous.
Did you blame the Czech government?
We blamed the big powers for intimidating President Beneš, who was a follower of Masaryk. And we felt that with a bit more guts and bit more independence, perhaps he wouldn't have to obey.
Did you ever, I think you were telling me earlier that you never felt that the danger of fascism was very close to you?
Not at all, not at all. There were few people very akin to your National Front, you know, you always find idiots everywhere. But it was minimal. It was minimal. It was a matter of laughter for us as students. No, nobody took them seriously. And they were certainly not in any way able to take power over.
But you also said you felt the danger of German fascism was remote as well.
Well, we were stupid. The means of communications were poor. All you had to do was listen to radio. And not seeing any of these horrors like we can see today on television. And having this feeling of a strong army and utter Czech education, I think even the older generation was not aware of the imminent danger. You see, it was a little bit like Mr. Chamberlain. We were hoping that the Germans will keep in their borders and perhaps attack east, because there was always this Drang nach Osten, the feeling that they wanted to have Poland or Ukraine. I'm speaking now in the hindsight. I mean, when I was young, I didn't think in these terms at all. It was pushed in the back of our conscience. The Czech papers were talking about the best book of the year and about the latest theater show and so on. And including my parents and including all my relatives who later died in Auschwitz, they were not aware of the danger. They really were not aware. And when they were aware of it, it was far too late. So in this case, the Czech Jews were the most naive one because they had the best deal, you see. They didn't feel Jewish. There were people living in Prague whose mother tongue was German, like Franz Kafka's, you know, generation. They were in a minority, they were terribly well treated, but they didn't feel at home because of the language barrier. And these people mostly packed their bags and went.
When?
Oh, in the good time, in 1937, 1938, because they were connected with what was going on in Germany. See, they were in touch. We were not.
Where did they go to?
Well, I think they tried to emigrate, God knows, to South America or wherever they could get a visa for.
Not to Germany?
No. They were aware of the fascists. They were aware of what was going on. They were aware of the old women and men sweeping the snow in the streets of Berlin and so on. They were really involved in the atrocities. While we in Czechoslovakia tried to push it away, it couldn't happen here. The Germans are cruel, the Germans are aggressive, but not our people, and we are surrounded by Czech people, so what, you see?
Did you come across Czechoslovak Germans, German-speaking Czechoslovaks, who were in favor of the Nazis?
No, not the Jewish one, certainly no. Then in Sudetenland, yes, but that was, again, whipped-up propaganda, you know. The Henlein, I don't know if you remember the name, the Henlein was a sort of a local Mosley, you know, who was supported from Germany, and he tried to make the German in Sudetenland hate the Czechs, which was unheard of. I mean, it was almost a situation like years ago in Cyprus, where the Turks and the Greek got on very well until they were provoked. And we used to go skiing because the place where the Germans were settled were this beautiful Riesengebirge, the beautiful mountains about an hour and a half from Prague, you know. And every year we went there, and every year we had a fabulous time, and these people were just as peaceful and happy to live in Czechoslovakia as they are today living in Austria. There wasn't a feeling of hatred at all. Again, probably, there were small circles of fascist youths who met and sang fascist songs, but nobody took notice of it, you see. It must have been going on for years.
Do you remember the German takeover very well, when the Germans actually moved in?
Yes, I remember very well. It was the 15th of March, Ides of March. It was snowing, and it was horrible. And I mean, it was very akin, I believe, what the Russians did in 1968, you know. Utter and complete surprise that they could really move with their tanks through there, because, you know, I heard Hitler shouting, he couldn't speak, he always shouted on the radio, saying, "Ich will ja keine Czechen, I don't want any Czechs, be assured that I won't get this tiny little nation, I don't need them, all I want is the border of Czechoslovakia." That was when he took Sudetenland, you see, and after screaming, "Ich will ja keine Czechen," of course, he sent the tanks in.
What did you actually see of the takeover?
Oh, well, people crying in the streets, people looking with utter amazement, the snow, despair. I suppose the same as it was in Paris when the tanks rolled in. Something which England was spared, you know. This feeling of a tiny little creature being squashed and squeezed. And of course, it was too late.
Did you see anything of the German forces?
Oh yes, they were marching through. They were marching through in utter silence. There wasn't a sound to be heard. There wasn't any, not even the German-speaking population didn't utter a single word. That's all.
Did the Germans make any attempt to win the hearts and minds of the Czechs?
No. They were clever enough not to realize it's absolutely futile. No flowers throwing, no greeting, no waving, nothing.
They didn't distribute sweets to the children?
Oh, no. No, there weren't any children in the street. There weren't any children in the street.
Once the German occupation took place, How was life affected personally for you?
Well, all I knew is that my boyfriend, whom I married very shortly afterwards, returned from the barracks terribly rejected, terribly unhappy. I spent the night waiting for him in his parents' house, and he came and he said we were shut there, we were locked up, and we didn't have any weapons, so we couldn't do anything. That was a feeling of utter dejection, because before then we thought, ah, we may do something, you see. So the army was annihilated by the politicians. Let's put it like this. Look, I didn't know too much about the inside and outside. I was worried about his life, and I was worried about what will happen, and dejected and unhappy, but I still didn't take it in. You don't take these events in. It's only when it's seen with the distance of 40 years that you realize what was really happening. I suppose it's the feeling of people in Belfast or anybody. You know, it can be few houses removed, and you don't really have the whole picture of what's going on. You only feel the tension and the dejection.
How was everyday life affected by the German takeover, if at all?
Tell you the truth, I don't remember. I don't remember really. They probably started to establish all sorts of rules and regulations, you know. They like to oppress people in an administrative way. And the persecution of the Jews went very slowly. That's another facet which people imagine, that we immediately were put to jail or immediately persecuted. It wasn't like that at all. They were very careful. They moved people from their own homes into smaller homes. My father lived in his own house and had another one. And the Germans were sort of a correct. They came with a lot of thick paper documents and let him sign almost lawyer-looking documents that he's giving up his houses. And my poor father turned the document over, which has about 20 pages, printed pages, and signed it on the back. And the German told him, "Won't you read it through?" I said, "What for? You're grabbing me off two houses, so what's the point?" Because in that was written, obviously, that, you know, counting with the fact that he will be killed, everything was legally done. I mean, they were not even openly robbing people. They were taking over in, in a documented way, which is a sick mind, isn't it?
Yes.
If you rob people, instead of saying, "I'm taking your house away, I'm taking your radio away, I'm taking your car away," you have this particular person has to legally sign it over. Sounds absurd, but it's true. They had it all documented that the Jews voluntarily gave away these things. Well, it started by dribbling. First, you have to take the radio away. No, that means they came and they took the radio. We had to queue with the radios in our hands to give it up. It was a farcical situation, because queuing with a nice Philips radio, a Czech boy ran to me and said, "Give me your Philips and I'll give you my old one which doesn't work," which I did. Why not? And the Czech population was absolutely puzzled about these things, you know. Psychologically, it's ridiculous. It was like a farce, like a black farce. Then, of course, they took away the cars. Then they moved the people from the good houses to small houses, where my father had to share a room with another man he didn't know. It was divided by a curtain. And so it slowly, slowly, and we still believe they may, after robbing us of every possible valuables, leave us in peace. Because they'd never announced you will be put into prison and you will go into concentration camp or something. We thought this is a part of rubbing the nation, you know. And only then I thought I married, very foolishly married, because my husband, my first husband, was only half Jewish. I didn't know, of course, about the laws that if he married a Jewish girl, he would be considered Jewish and I would drag him into annihilation. He was killed because of me, but I did not know, neither did he. So we married. We married basically because our parents were old-fashioned and they wouldn't allow to be lovers, you know, unless you married. It wasn't like today. And we moved into a little village where his uncle had a factory. And we saw being tucked away from Prague, being, you know, in a sort of a oasis of countryside. We wouldn't be so exposed and perhaps we could survive there working, because they sent all the, he was a student of law, and they sent all these people into factories. So he came into that factory and worked as a worker in the factory. And I must say I was very happy, very much in love and hoping to survive. And the first inkling of the absurdity was then when they suddenly distributed the yellow stars and every Jew had to wear the yellow stars, which again, you know, if you're young, you don't take it so seriously. You think, all right, I'm going to wear a yellow star, so what? The people in the village laughed at it. They were very good. They were pointing, definitely they were more polite than ever before because of the yellow star. They were greeting me with all the lovely titles, you know, gracious lady, how are you this morning? That was the habit. But, like everywhere, there was one woman whose son immediately got a job with the Gestapo. It's the local Gestapo, which was in a small town very near to that village. And that particular woman made me to be sent into the first prison I was ever in. I was watching with a friend local boys playing other boys in a match of football, but it was not a match of football with audiences. You know, they were just playing like boys play on the green, on the village green. The village green was a sloping ground, so the ball finished always in a local pond. And, well, we were watching. And the next morning came a knock on the door, and the Czech gendarme said, I'm terribly sorry, it's so painful, but I have to bring you to prison. And I said, why? What happened? Said, Mrs. Polachkova wasn't lazy to go to the local Gestapo in Kostelec, which was the little town next to the village, and said that you watched football and Jews are not allowed to watch football. So he took me into a train and I wanted to pay my ticket. And he said, oh, no, no, prisoners don't have to pay. You are riding free. And he brought me to the local jail. And again, the director of the jail was so terribly embarrassed that he said, look, I have to do it. The Gestapo asks for it. But I won't close your door in the cell. I'll leave it open, yes? I said, no, please close it, because the jail was full of thieves and gypsies and God knows, rather suspicious types, you see. So I said, would you be so very kind and close the door at night, because I'm a little bit apprehensive about these people. So I was in jail for a fortnight for watching football. Well, I took it as a joke, because it was so absurd, and Peter Sellers couldn't go better. And I didn't realize that at the same time another person was in that jail and was sent immediately from that particular little jail into concentration camp. So it was a miracle I returned home and laughed about the whole story. Then about a year later, no, longer, in 1942, they suddenly put us all together in a transport and transported us to Theresienstadt, to the ghetto.
Before you go on to Theresienstadt, could I ask you about the attitudes of the Czechs to the German regime? Did you see much in the way of resistance?
No. No, simply because the country doesn't lend itself to it. The resistance was in the mountains in Slovakia, where you can hide, where you can make a sort of a partisan units without being caught and hung immediately. There was a resistance in Czechs underground, political underground, certainly. There was more, I would say, an intellectual resistance, passive resistance. There were leaflets printed in the cellars. They were distributed. There was a moral support, a tremendous moral support, and the belief that Hitler can't win and he will certainly lose the war. It never occurred to us that he would win. You see, I was surprised after the war to hear that people, even in England, believed he could win. We had enough information to know about the valiant, it was fantastic what we heard about England. We were listening to BBC. Now, for example, in that little village, there was a priest, Moravian brother priest, Mr. Reichel, who was a hero, a real hero. He was preaching in the open, starting with the Bible, saying, "The swines overran the vineyards of the Lord." And I came to him and said, "You know, Mr. Reichel, considering Mrs. Polachkova and types like this, you will finish in prison." And he said, "I know, I know." And he finished in prison, and thank God he came back. And he was listening every evening to the World Service from Bush House, and we were coming to him, and we were all obviously in danger of life. But again, you did not realize the extent of the danger, you see. We knew they would be after us. But as we have never been in any concentration camp and haven't seen any execution, we couldn't imagine. These things are above normal human beings, isn't it? If you're brought up in a peaceful land. You know, the only murder I remember in Czechoslovakia, it was not a violent society. You see, there was a man called Lecian who killed his mistress, and people were talking about it for about 20 years. Today we live in a time where killing and murdering and firing, it's every day. But I don't know how it was before the war in England, but it was idyllic. You could walk at midnight through the park in Prague, returning from the theater. Nothing would happen to you.
You mentioned the leaflets. Did you receive any leaflets?
Not I. They were not preaching to the converted. It would have been foolish. They were distributing these things very largely to people who could do something about it. As a manifestation of heroics, you probably know the men of Seifert.
Seifert,
the poet who got the Nobel Prize now.
No?
No? Well,